Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
podcast while walking. The 10th of May. I'm going to cover a few things, scientific approach to weight loss. You know, some of the ins and outs of that, because strangely, people are more interested in that than sort of any other. They're more interested in weight loss than, say, or anything to do with science. And then they might be more interested in strokes than science. Interesting aspect of it. And I've just made sure that I've got the microphone in the absolute correct place. And as I'm walking along here, I'm walking on the standard route to the national park. My back's a little bit sore, and it's icy cold. I'd say probably, well, lucky it's 11 or 12 degrees here in Australia. So, you know, it's got that real icy nip. The temperature may be there, but you can sort of feel that it's snowed somewhere up in the Alps, or the Australian Alps, which, you know, most people wouldn't recognise as Alps. So what I want to cover is topic of, scientific approach to weight loss, and then I want to get into the vagaries of trying to actually push new physics, new quantum physics. That sounds a bad thing, but I just have to do this. So look, the fundamental thing is with weight loss, obviously your weight is to an extent calories in versus calories and I suppose waste out, but there's a little bit more to it in that you hold water inside you. You have different fuel sources. You have quick fuel sources and slow fuel sources, and all these complexities. And there's also the fact about how, over what time scale, your physiology and stores react to food input. So although there is a certain amount of instant, if you have a cup of water, 250 grams of water, your weight increases 250 grams. And if you urinate that amount, your weight changes by that amount. But there are other things involved. And so let's talk about it. Now, there's obviously a huge, something I've discovered, a huge power structure to do with food. It's got a huge social thing of sitting together and eating the same quantity and being seen to eat the same quantity, and how you're served and who controls things. And so although there may be a male control system, there is this other sort of female control area in which you're served things. So if you don't eat a proper amount of food, and there's a sort of a rule system across there, you're punished and then released and then still punished, and go things like that. So let's do it. You obviously, now, strangely, you know, we have a food shortage. We have shortages of food amongst the world, yet we've got a large amount of people who are obese, and a lot of people are obese there. Now, one of the things, this is fat. And one of the interesting things here is that you don't linearly put on the amount of weight. So if you eat, say, 5 kilos of food, you'd be lucky to put on an extra 500 grams. And if you're thin, you put on, say, 1 kilogram. And if you're very, very fat already, you don't put on that additional extra amount of weight. Your body, you know, hopefully drops in efficiency. And so food waste is really waste. So the effect of eating additional food, the body knows not to just use additional food. It decreases it, and actually just, you basically shit out a fair amount of your food. So if you're hungry, your efficiency of taking the food increases. Now, if you actually consider the whole world and the cost of the planet of food waste, there's all that food, 100 kilograms of food produced, 50 kilograms, just goes to waste. We select it, we sort it, we tip it away, and the 50 kilograms gets to you. Now, if we have, the ability to survive on less food as a country, so just overall, we produce excess food. We also produce food which can be stored, and we also devalue the nutritional value of food to make it storable, more merchandisable. So it's something which can sell it easier, more easily, but we have induced more waste into it by actually processing it, which takes up energy. So it achieves a certain merchandisability, but it actually means the actual per kilogram amount of food drops down. So, say 40 of your 100 kilograms of food, we may reduce that to effectively 25 kilograms of food by actually processing it, making it easier to sell and store, more merchandise, and more profitable to go. Because so there's a lot of aspects to eating the correct or reduced amount of food in terms of storage. And so if you can think of it, if you could actually save for every meal you cook, put a third of it away, and then eat that third again the next day as a meal, you could actually save a huge amount of food and energy preparing things. Now, one of the things is that there's sort of, if your body is operating correctly, it can stabilize weight. Now, what happened with me is I had a heart valve problem, which led to a liver problem, led to a kidney problem, and I began to just swell up with water. So I increased weight, not for any addition in eating of food, but just basically swelling up with water. And I had to really exercise to burn off any extra energy, try and lose weight desperately, and also just to breathe. So one of the things is that walking over a period of time, you got into the rhythm and it actually just helped you breathe. So you went all across there. So I sort of started off at a very high weight, 97, 98 kilograms. And then after the operation dropped down to 96 kilograms, got down to 94, had another operation, went up to 96, went down to 94, stayed around 96. And basically had to look at a correct weight that you had to aim down to. Now, essentially, you can sort of pick up, there's sort of two aspects to work out what correct weight you want to get to. One is that you can go through the body mass indicator, and that's a little bit of a fudged, sort of rubbery number, so to speak. As far as I can see, it gives you your height, and your height squared. I think that's fundamentally it. It's to do with your height squared. Now, there's a sort of little bit of a, I don't know, yeah, so you just get to be high. I think there might be a difference between males and females, but essentially your height squared. Now, essentially, it sort of means that you expect tall people to be skinnier, because if you've got a sphere and you double the height of the sphere, the actual volume and the same density, it should go as a cube. Now, in most organic chemical systems, there is a power law, but it's not an integer power law. It's a lot of reactions that go up to the, say, 2.3 or 1.6, of the concentration, stuff like that. And a lot of things in nature follow power laws, but they're not a linear power law, because essentially there's a whole range of systems operating and differential equations coming off, and basically the power law is the first approximation falling off the system. So although a particular reaction may go require three molecules to occur, the rate of reaction might be the concentration to 3.1, because it's just some other quantum mechanical factor in there. So this is using your body mass index will give you a particular weight, and so they just basically I think it's just measure your height. I think it is your height produces a weight, and so my height, the magic weight, is 82 kilograms. And there's another way of getting into that, and that is the checking for additional body fat around here. And basically, if you can grab a fold of fat from your tummy, you're a bit overweight, and go around the place, and you can sort of feel how fatty you are and how muscular you are. So the body mass index can make you the say, in my case, I'm aiming for 82. I could be the 82 kilograms and still of the 82 kilograms, I could have 15 kilograms of fat or 1 kilogram of fat. And so obviously there's a certain amount of inaccuracy in it. And essentially you want to reduce weight. I think there's the simple thing that it makes exercise a bit easier if you're not as heavy. It's walking up these things, and if you have impact stuff, your fat bounces up and down. It's a bit difficult going across, and there's a sort of a heart pumping against it. Now, my heart's in fact not a weak heart. So it's a, I'm sure that was a friend going past. Whoops. He was off like anything. And in fact, when they opened it up, it was a very powerful heart, but with a few problems. I'm not saying, whoa, I've got a powerful heart. This is one of their problems. Normally, if you get a heart with problems, it's a weak heart, and symptoms are really obvious. So you can sort of balance having a welch. So essentially, as I was going downhill, I was exercising like buggery, and so that sort of kept me afloat a bit more, and it definitely did mean that when I had the second operation, I bounced back much better, because I had the benefit of a slightly repaired heart and exercise and determination to really, really get going. So, I had the problem of bouncing around 94 to 97 kilograms for a while, and then slowly taking control and losing pretty much a fixed amount per day. And of course, you've got to say, well, what was going on? Why was I bouncing around? Well, I was bouncing around because essentially the sort of control input and output were not tightly controlled, and they weren't tightly controlled, and the measurement wasn't tightly controlled. So imagine if you want to get down to a certain amount of kilograms, if you don't lose kilograms for 3 days and then lose it all in one day, you're really punishing your body. Oh, you can hear one of these bloody coal trains coming past. Is it still coming through? Yeah. Oh. It's not all that noisy now. You can hear the engines making it, and these are all the probably 60 or 100 carriages of coal going up the mountains, or going down the mountains. Going empty, going up. So it will go across to a coal mine and deliver it to a station, or some combination of that. I don't know exactly how it works. It's a pretty mad process. So ideally, let's say what you really want to do is, if you could lose, hopefully more than 10 grams a day, because 10 grams a day will take you 100 days. Is it 100? Yeah. 100 days to lose a kilo, 100 days to lose a kilogram. You might lose at 100 grams a day, 3.6 kilograms over a year. So that might be okay if you can, if that's what you want to do. But you want to sort of, nose in, get everything organized and sort of lose ideally, you know, I think about 50 grams a day, 75 grams a day, that would be sort of absolutely ideal. Now, with the heart valve and stuff like that, all of the initial weight was liquid, and so they had a diuretic, furosemide or something like that, and so it basically drained you out a little bit and sort of stopped you absolutely bursting at the seam. And then you obviously want to aim for a certain weight loss per day. Now that sounds a bit hard to contemplate, because if you can't weigh yourself accurately to really 100 grams, that's 0.1 kilogram, accurately, there's sort of no way that your brain can sort of feed back and you can sort of concentrate and get going. So really the first step to stopping my weight oscillating was not my lifestyle, but the instrument. I got a higher grade instrument, basically higher and higher grade, and basically began setting up as a scientific instrument, which really required me to put the scales in the same position in the bathroom each time. So it does vary, put your feet in the same location on the scale each time, and measure at the same point, not the same time, but the same point, which is in the morning just before I go to the toilet, and that's just after, just to pick up what's going on. And that gives you a certain amount of information. Now, incredibly, so let's go into what goes on. So incredibly, you could pretty well say you lose 400 to 500 grams at night when you sleep, doing nothing, no exercise, just breathing along. You lose that amount of weight, and I really do think that's just moisture just coming out of your body. Like, you, if you look at something, if you touch something, we're a little bit, not on the edge, we're not dry like a kitten, we're a bit moist, a bit ugh. I'm sure that other animals, when they touch us, go, what the heck is that? So at night, I lose about half a kilogram sleeping. And so that's important, that you don't want to really measure yourself in the morning and then measure yourself at the evening. You've got the next half kilogram that you're going to lose. So it's best to do it after there. And then incredibly, you possibly lose something in the actual process of your body digesting and the blood doing anything and filtering out. You lose, you can have 300 grams of water come out with urine. So that together is about a kilogram fluctuation. So if you, depending on, and I really don't know how much you fluctuate, and of course, if you can remove that fluctuation, the fluctuation from the device, the scales that you're measuring with, and obviously you want to do it in a nud. I think essentially that's a given, because your clothes do weigh a different amount, so you want to actually get a really accurate measurement. And even then, there is a variation. Now, the variations come into if you succumb to eat some junk food, you can say, well, that really... So if you drink... So what happened to me is that I, just out of habit, out of nostalgia almost, I had a thick shake, McDonald's thick shake. I'm sort of no longer eating any McDonald's. I just went in there, had a thick shake, and then I didn't lose any weight that particular particular day. And there are certain things where you eat a little bit more than you should, partly because it tastes so bloody well good, and you've paid for it. So you eat it. I had a beautiful prawn salad, absolutely scrumptious at the Croydon Club. So let's talk about these clubs which are funded by gambling. So it's a bit of a... So this is poker machines, and it's sort of a social place where people are not very high, necessarily high status, pensioners. I met a few demented people there. I actually mean people. Demented, spoke with a few people. It's just a general community place, but the food was absolutely scrumptious, and I had this prawn stuff, all this huge amount of green rocket and avocado and beautiful, beautiful sauce. Unfortunately, on the warfarin blood thingers for the mechanical valve I had, I've just got a mouthful of rocket, really absolutely savour it, and that's it. And I have to actually put all that huge pile of green away. I sort of had to get on it. And so that particular day, I was locked into, I had a bit of discretionary food, a bit of social enjoyment food, and then I just got this really, oh, this is my memory. I had cannelloni, and I had to make the family cannelloni, or my wife makes up the mixture. I squish it in, and we put it in, and for that, I was able to limit myself to rather than three, two, so the two looked the same. I squished those two cannelloni out, so it looked as big as everybody else's meal. So did I put, accordingly, the weight that I've got down to is, I think it was 87.6. And, let's see how we go here. And again, on that day, I didn't do any exercise. So you go into it that if you can restrict the food that you eat, increase the exercise that you do, and there's sort of a longer term things flowing into what's going on. And some of them are, that if, it seems to be that you have to restrict your food for a couple of days or, going in, before you start to see a turn off, and, you basically have to, I suppose, vary your exercise, or not do the same exercise each day. Now, on top of that, I've got another thing that I have to do, and that is improve my part of cognitive rehabilitation is for each exercise I do, I have to actually see if I can do some sort of mental activity on top of it, overlay the two. That really sort of, doing exercise really improves the benefit of the cognitive activity. Now, there's sort of a limit to what you can do. I was trying to podcast while on an exercise bike, and that was unfortunately a little bit hard. Now, in this case, I've got the benefit of podcasting, which has got my mind active, and also walking at the same time, so unfortunately might get a bit rough for you out there in podcast land. So, essentially, getting back into weight loss, you have to actually tune yourself into your weight machine, tune yourself out of the social pressures that is, you'll quickly discover, I quickly discovered, that there are social taboos and social habits, internal and external to you. So internally you may have a series of process reward systems. Now, obviously, people behind counters are trained to smile and offer and give you positive rewards. So essentially, the people who don't do that are out of business. And so you can have a system, and then you can plan, and you can say, have in your brain, I'm going to, you know, things to do, and it's just an easy thing to plan. Oh, I'm going to go over here and buy this, and that's sort of dead time as you're waiting around to do it. Sort of like it's a relaxation aspect to it. So there's that internal aspect to it, but then there's the external aspect to it, that it's a very social thing. There's a lot of power controlled in food, and I just spoke to my GP and today, not on food, not that much, and I instantly knew that there was all this complexity with the society, power, food, and it's really interesting in that it seems to be people are very basically have a different brain that they operate when it comes to food, that they're can suddenly calculate enormous things about how to do recipes, halve things, give serves exactly the same size, and all that type of stuff. But then there seems to be a sudden drop in inhibition between what you can comment on. You know, should you be eating that? Are you eating fast enough? All these things that you perhaps normally wouldn't be. You wouldn't say, should you be reading that? Should you be sitting there? Should you have the light on? But if it involves food, it's a sudden sudden invitation to get across. Now, unfortunately, you have to, with all of these things, you can't change it instantly. You just have to identify and condition yourself and condition people around you. Now, the other result is to actually have a sort of statistical analysis of the numbers that you're going in, and if you haven't actually dealt with variables and trends and numbers, you can sort of, I suppose, get to what I see with students, that they say if you have a sort of fairly rough thermometer on it, they'll look at the thermometer every once in a while and and just write it down. But if you've got a digital scale and you've set it up, and you can easily do this, set it up to such that it's got enormous accuracy. So this is actually higher accuracy than, higher accuracy than its normal digital accuracy. When I say accuracy, precision, and so you may have something which is precise to, I don't know, effectively say 25%. So, but it goes from, it's got the units 0, 25, 50, 75, and 10, next like that. Now, if you have it there and then it's averaging, it can produce the appearance. So if it does 10,000 reads and you've got some noise in it, and this is the most incredible thing, obviously, if you can add a bit of noise to the system, make it less stable, less accurate, it can actually bounce around the noise and actually have a zero, which is more sensitive. So say if you had a scale system which is perfectly stable, and went down to, so 10.1, it would be zero all the time. But if you had a noise signal on top of that of, say, 0.2, really bad noise signal, that 0.2 would trip it up to 2.5 some of the time and zero the other rest of the time. And hey presto, you've got actual access to much higher precision. Now, and so you will actually get a readout of, so this is something that you'll get a poor readout. You had some noise into it, random noise or oscillation into it. You will get suddenly be able to pull out a higher precision, a higher accuracy, higher precision on top of it. It's a little bit woolly, so to speak, but it definitely does work. And so you can, so there's a whole series of these magical things where you can actually get far higher precision. And human feedback systems operate like this, with a noise system in it, overlaid with a digital steps, plus noise, then plus averaging gives you precision far higher, greater than you can get. Now, but the result is your also ability to use that precision. So if that precision is hidden from you, you will tend to automatically do your own mental averaging and see where it's going anyway. But if the precision is shown to you, you can actually get spooked by it and actually try and actually read these small, tiny variations. So say for me, I've gone down really from 94 to this 87.6, pretty much on possible, this is just an probable example, 0.4 with a standard deviation of 0.2. So occasionally, one day in 10, that I'll go two standard deviations above and not lose any weight. And then the next time I will go under, but it's sort of, it's a variation from that trend, so to speak. So it goes down there. Now, if you are like one of these students and actually start recording down to impossible accuracy, it's not that the accuracy is impossible, it's just that it's not that the accuracy is impossible, it's just your mental significance that you're going to apply to it. So in the point, you've sort of got a memory that you are going down, and I suppose basically coach yourself in there. So in this particular case, I had sort of rice bubbles for breakfast. What did I have? Possibly no lunch. A few biscuits for lunch, and in the social setting, my allocated 3 pies. My son has got a pie maker and had that. And then realization of this clocking into your head that you have to do this a certain amount of exercise. I've just decided to do a certain amount of exercise, again, realizing I have to produce a certain number of podcasts per day, going across, I've done that. Now, hopefully I'll be able to get in on top of that. And there's these other statements which are really, I don't know, it's sort of really interesting in terms of that there are truths that people almost, take religiously. These are viewpoints and judgments which are backed up by everyone thinks that. And I can't quite describe it, but there's an idea that to everyone goes on a crash diet and then basically a digital behaviour, and when the stimulus goes away, they put the weight straight back on it. And this, of course, is obviously a bit different from a precision linear diet of aiming for about 50 grams a day. Yeah, it's a slightly different approach, and one has to see if one has actually, and you've got all this, oh my God, there's a car coming up here at night. What are you doing? What the heck is this? You poor bastard. What are they going to do? I don't probably, sorry, so what happens is there's a food system here, a park system, and you have gates which locked you in, and I don't know what they're going to do. Oh, there's perhaps toilets up here, some may be camped. I don't understand what the heck they're doing. It's sort of, you get locked in the national park, and sort of what it means is essentially it's just good park management to lock up Australia's national parks, so you can't obviously we've got vast national parks and there's nowhere. I don't know. I seriously don't know. It's probably someone who's camping and sick. That might be some of them. I don't know what the story is. So essentially what's happened there is that they have a car on the other side, and the person's got a car greeted them. So that's a bit there. And so this is bloody hell dangerous, because normally at night in the national park, there's one thing you don't have to worry about: cars. There's no, even though they're little country tracks there. And I'm sort of going down here as part of the sort of the focus on. Now, what I was saying before was that people have this view, that sort of detached view of saying, sort of inductive logic. You are a member of this social group. This social group has these rules, therefore that will affect you. And if you say it doesn't, you, it excludes you from the social group. So if you say, I went on a diet and then I gained weight, it's sort of like, and I'm a member of your group. It's sort of a bit crazy. It could well be if you've sort of precision lost 50 grams a day for 100 days, what's 50 grams a day? What's that? 50 grams a day is 5 kilograms for 100 days, so it's a reasonable. And if you've lost it precisely and you've gotten control of the actual behavioural aspects of it, like controlling your food intake and all that type of stuff to get there, it's still going to be extraordinary that you suddenly go, oh, I've been losing 50 grams for 100 days, I've got my goal, I'm just going to be totally detached from it, I'll go across. So I've got my goal of 82 grams, kilograms, and it's not a goal, it's still just a point in a curve, and given that I've written, built robot control systems for overshoot and all this type of stuff, I'll probably go down for, I don't know, 81 kilograms, stick on that for a while, and then just do, you know, sort of pull back monitoring on it. And I suppose the critical thing is that I don't know whether external coaching is that effective, because it means that you are surrendering your control system to external factors, and those external factors haven't helped you in the past. You've just changed them, and then you haven't changed your reliance on external factors. So I've got a big question myself on whether how you respond to those external factors. You want to just disengage and hose down this entire sort of subtext of membership of a group. You're saying, oh, I hear what you're saying. I'm not very skilled in understanding what you're saying. You build a sort of a not moving away, but you're introducing a complicated passage between external force and then you also change the timing of it. So rather than responding instantly, I'll tell you in a few months as I'm just going along minding my own business. So I'm just going to follow the path of minding my own business, rather mind your own business. I'm going to mind my own business. And so I might be able to give you a rational response to that. So there's all these subtle ways that you can actually not to tell people to be rational and mind your own business. You can say, well, I'm going to give minding my own business a little bit of a go here, and I'm going to check whether I'm indeed rational or irrational, and perhaps the rational irrational might be the key to getting on top of things. We'll just keep on doing it, and I've got an open mind. I think essential for me personally is that gap between when you weigh yourself, that being able to have a bit of time to process that in reset and say, well, I'm going to do this here, and then you pour your breakfast cereal out, might be rice or might be Special K or something like that, and you say, I'm having a little bit more than I should here, but it's only one bowl of cereal, and it's not that much more. But you sort of have a go to it, and hopefully that will get across. And I'll definitely get back to you if this suddenly bungs. But if you can imagine basically a oscillating graph, click change. Change scale, reduce, then scale, reduce again. That is the mechanism there. So that's gone on a fairly tight line, and then a bit of coaching, I think, and then slowly tipping off a straight line onto a gentle gradient down, in which you basically have this. Control, and of course going down, you sort of it's like you're descending down into lower altitude. You pick up, let's analyze this response. Oh, this person's upset, you haven't eaten. Oh, there's a sort of a social, let's go back and let's look at, there's a social aspect to it. Or these people say they've been on diets, it's been unsuccessful, but let's listen to what they have to say. And quickly, soon after, oh my God, here comes the car again. Listening through. So that must be the story. So what time of night? It's about 9 o'clock at night. No, probably 8 o'clock at night, so that person, I don't know, that might have been, got work the next day. So, what is it, Friday? Wow. Who knows? Who knows? Or who knows what the story is? And it's a remarkable situation with his mobile phone coverage, radio control, control there. Essentially, it looks a light on the hill. It looks like a strange light on the hill, and it's actually just the moon going through the trees there. I'll tell you what, that used to super spook me at night. So when I was, you'd be on patrol, you'd be on sentry duty, and you look out and you'd suddenly catch this little light through the trees and go, far out. Yeah, and it would be, say, an orange light. And, oh, Jesus, what's that? And you go, you look for a long time, and then you see it again, and you go, oh my God, there's something out there on the next ridge. And then, of course, you would be a star rising up through the staff. Bottom line is to get on top of it. And this is not the only thing you have to watch. One is getting your heart rate up and controlling your heart rate. And these things sort of come in. So essentially you've got now a heart rate monitor and an app, and you can just get your heart rate up into the zone for a fixed period of time. You can actually lock into it. But I must admit that becomes incredibly, incredibly boring to push through. So as promised, these podcasts go for over an hour. Anyone who's ever bothered to listen to it, and I shudder to think of anybody ever bothering to listen to it. The second thing I really want to do is talk about, I think, bogus folk science and how it really gets embedded, sort of similar to like bogus folk weight loss, bogus weight science gets embedded in. And essentially, what is it? You get a bit overwhelmed, I think, by just really, really incredibly bad science. And there was a I can't work out why, so there was a YouTube by this group called Socratic, and there's something that caught me instantly about it in terms of that I'm sort of looking at how you get traction with kids, and to, you know, what fraction of the time that a very small kid would be interested in a puppet speaking to them. But they had, in Socratic, they had these puppets speaking about atomic theory. And so you immediately go, oh, gee, that's you know, what level of understanding can you really get there? Can you really pump the facts in so quickly on this without, you know, what's going on there? What fraction going on? And essentially, there were two puppets there saying, one was Kermit and one was Muppet's monster, two going together. But the Kermit was a female, and so slightly different. And there was just only a very slightest difference to the Kermit frog, and the monster was out and out, stuff like that. And I began to watch it, and I said, oh, this really needs to be nailed. And I thought, oh, how can I nail it? Because it's out there, it's got huge cognitive load, and really you just have to play it and make a comment on it. So I thought, oh, well, this is obviously in breach of copyright. I'm not going to create a greater problem by actually breaching the copyright. I'll be able to just film this, and it's sort of legitimate to critique there, because, you know, the internet, you know, so I thought, look, there's nothing to go on. And of course, I basically laid into this, but not in a sort of tirade, you know, entertaining manner. I just sort of would play a certain amount and actually, you know, say, oh, look, they've said the wrong thing here. This is incorrect. This is poor teaching. This is teaching by the incorrect method. You're making a value judgment of the worth of this monster, and this monster has given a poor quality answer, but it's the answer that the frog wants, so the frog is saying that you're not so stupid. Then the monster actually did itself in. I think it said, I'm cutting the cheese. And that apparently is a US sort of kiddie story for cutting the cheese, means for farting. And so, look, this is just, the whole thing was insane. And it just went on and on, just incredibly. So I basically would do the video a little bit, pause it and then interject a sort of a slideshow on the exact answer. Now, the incredible thing is that atoms essentially are one step beyond our concrete world. So what atom has a smaller part, but because of quantum mechanics, a smaller thing is as big as the whole. So the atom is the size of its smallest part, and bigger parts are smaller, and they sit inside it. So this is a bit hard to get your mind around, but essentially you couldn't access that. If you could say that outright, and you could possibly get it across to people, but your ability to teach quantum mechanics is reduced by getting to a kid when they're really young and telling them the incorrect stuff. So it's got a... I didn't say this at the point, but this type of teaching is making it extremely difficult to teach the correct stuff, the correct high mathematics as you go up, because essentially the assumption that all things can be taught in a concrete way through experience, the atom is something which transcends experience. So the electron, being the lightest part, is the size of the atom, and all the other components of the atom sit within that, through space, sit through within the atom. That is, that the basic thing that see this block, I can't put another block through it, therefore all blocks are like that. That actually doesn't apply for the atom. So the electrons slide through each other in space. So I'm going uphill now, hopefully getting up to it. So I'm just catching my breath as I'm going up here. So that's the essential thing. And so the essential problem we have here, sort of similar to the weight loss thing, is that I prime people with information. I sort of push poll, and I get almost a democratic, a free will vote, which really isn't free will, and your expression of free will is more a social thing with respect to your acceptance in the community. And essentially, this is what this frog was manipulating the monster by saying, you're very good, you're not so stupid, you're one of us now that you have been able to recite this information. And you're quite clever if you can use linguistic associative knowledge to actually say these things. And it said a neutron doesn't have a charge, it doesn't want to get in a fight. Electron is negative, but it's not a bad thing. It's not bad. It's really confused stuff, and the frog says, that's it, you've got it. That level of really rubbish knowledge thought is what I've used, and I'm a member of the club, so welcome on board. And if you use anything else, not quite so. If you use anything else which is more high-level knowledge, you can't do it. And so, of course, kids who watch this video aren't really learning anything but bad intellectual habits. And I went into it, and then been unbridledly stupid. It went on to list different sorts of electricity, and one is static electricity, one is natural electricity, and the other is PowerPoint electricity. Now, of course, again, this is sort of another example of blocking a kid's ability to understand something by preloading with poor quality information. So similar to this weight loss stuff, a lot of people, their girdle is caused by poor intellectual scholarship at a critical time. They obviously are not that bright and not able to basically not have a second bowl of chips or whatever it is. Consistently, that is obviously what is happening. And they are not able to review the fact that their intellectual system isn't good enough. And so you've got to actually, A, give them crap knowledge, and B, give them crap ability to assess the fact they've got crap knowledge. You've got to give them that package deal, otherwise you're going to have someone who will just walk away from it and work out the right answer, you've got to actually anchor them to stupid knowledge. And essentially, this is what this video was doing. It just went from bad to worse, and so I just looked up a few angles and just absolutely hammered it. And I got my first copyright infringement notice, and it gave me the name. I think it was MarkLightSocratic.com, and I did the mandatory training of YouTube and a warning that, you know, I had three strikes, sort of like a merit demerit point system we have in Australia. If you get caught speeding, you get lost one demerit point. You get caught speeding in a day where they want you to pay attention to the safety, you get two demerit points, and there's really no arguments of it. And when you go there, lose that, you lose your argument, you lose your license, and that's it. There's really no point going across it. So, YouTube has this demerit system, and that's all. Oh well. I clearly stated that I was copying their system in order to comment on it, and that it was in breach of copyright anyway, so it was sort of in a grey area. So I sent an email up to this MarkLightSocratic.com and said, hey, sorry, yeah, that's what's happened, but, you know, clearly you were in breach of copyright, but let's forget all about this. Let's talk about getting the correct information across in the correct way. I will help your company teach correctly. No response. And so that was a bit chilling, because essentially they were protecting their corporate image, which is not what they're supposed to do. It is not an image, it's an actuality that ultimately, and essentially, therein goes like counterfeit thinking in terms of if the real deal was there, review and relationships would be in place. So it's a symptom of sort of a counterfeit connections that, and this problem that you encounter is a symptom of a much broader situation. And something a bit related to it. So that's covered, and they've never got back to me. And I sort of feel like saying to YouTube, well, I've got this ruling against it. Can we look into it? That's going to be interesting. So, but the end result was that there was a brief window where in the place there was all this counterfeit stuff, some counterfeit stuff, and there was a window into pointing to counterfeit, and then what they did is they removed the counterfeit stuff and the window, and we're back to the baseline of only counterfeit knowledge out there. Now, this thing, so there's a very similar story and a very similar set of relationships, and this is the Science Teachers Association, New South Wales, for their physics conference, wanted to organise a rerun of a tour they've done in the distance past, and that's to visit the Australian Nuclear Science and Technology Organisation's synchrotron, which was essentially, what's been happening is that we've been privatising everything except for high science technology. Doesn't work on a small scale in a distributed country. And so what's happened is that bit by bit, the services, the actual infrastructure, sort of like McDonald's, is ancillary. And similar to McDonald's, you've got this large corporate infrastructure and a basically a corporate PR system, and essentially everyone's getting the same hamburger throughout Australia and same information, same packaging, and the feeling of conformity from fast food place from Anstey. So they have this synchrotron. Now, Anstey has probably three major problems. First is the periodic table is a bit whack, so if it's not modernized, and so you say, look, can I help you with it? Blank. It's sort of like saying, oh, look, can I improve the nutritional value of your hamburger? McDonald's wouldn't like that. Now, that's not so crazy. I know someone who had an ultrasonic sensor that you could put in the hamburger fat, the chip fat, and it would mechanically lift the fat off, lift the chips up within a fraction of a second and optimize the health value of your chips. So, if you can imagine the population of Australia, by the amount of chips they eat, if you improve the health value of those chips by 5%, you've got so many people living. It's sort of worthwhile, and the detector and circuit, couple of bucks, not interested. So similarly, they have problems in their periodic table, which could be fixed, and really it is this corporate system. So for counterfeit knowledge, the next really important thing is their iconic nucleus that they're talking about is incorrect. It's the ball or liquid drop model from 1936, which lasted only a few months before it was unable to explain things like radioactivity, energy levels, you know, things like this impact, and all these fundamental things that you want a nuclear model to describe. And so there's a thread of sort of neoclassical nuclear physics, which had things in the Kao knowledge novel. A thing that is, so I have a neutron and a proton in deuterium. They can't actually go occupy the same point in space. So in order to it, they must have a repulsive potential to keep them apart. Well, and similarly, there must be some hand-waving thing to stop a tiny electron hitting the nucleus. Whereas in quantum mechanics, they can actually sit over each other in space. And that's what they do, and the electron sits over itself, over the atom, the nucleus of space. So there's a tiny fraction, in fact, per unit volume, the highest. So for, if I've got a nucleus, say, of 1 unit volume, and then can move that unit volume around the atom and detect where the most likely position of an electron is, the S-shell electron is most likely to be inside the nucleus, or it's got the highest density inside the nucleus. Now, similar to the poor counterfeit training, which has corrupted everyone's mind, they can't think this way because they've been instructed incorrectly. And so we come to Anstey. There is a bit of classical physics in their cyclotron. That is that the path at different radiuses, so circles of different radiuses have a length proportional to their radius, and if you set it up, they have their speed proportional to radius. Add those two things together, a particle will arrive at its acceleration zone at the same frequency. And so you organize the acceleration to occur at the cyclotron frequency, and you can accelerate a proton up to sufficiently high energy such that it impacts an oxygen 18 and knocks out a neutron, making fluorine 18, which is unstable due to quantum mechanics, not due to anything else. That is, even number of protons and neutrons are more stable due to spin equalization, and other factors. So fluorine 18 will decay to oxygen 18 with the emission of a positron, and therefore you get your chemistry after. So that steps there. But you need then unpack this, and if you show a proton hitting a sort of a bag of grapes, and that bag of grapes miraculously transfers the momentum to the other side, and another grape goes off at the other side, you can basically dress yourself up in a white coat, put glasses, and seriously say that. But we know that if I had a big cluster of rocks all glued, all stuck together, and I had another rock in a Shanghai and I hid it, that wouldn't happen. You wouldn't get something peeping out the other side. Now, people's ability to logically rationalize it is their ability to be a member of a group. So getting back to the dieting thing, I'm not going on a diet. It's not going to be successful. I'm not going to bother getting all these steps up, because so this trust in the suit, this trust in teachers, is starting this 1936 a liquid drop model, way beyond its use by day, and it requires a corporate rethink for what we're going to go ahead. Now, there is this quasi Born approximation for quantum physics, that is, that the envelope represents a region of space in which there is a certain probability of something coming into existence and disappearing from one point to the other. Now, this concept is only believable because of authority. It's not. So, if you can imagine yourself in the house, and you spend a lot of the time in front of the TV, a little time at the back in the toilet, a little bit of time in the attic and stuff like that, and you plot that. Now, at any point in time, you could say, well, by the orders of quantum physics, let quantum begin, and you disappear out of existence in the living room and reappear instantaneously in the attic, and then you instantaneously in the attic, you reappear in the toilet and all that type of stuff. G'day. So that's stupid. However, that concept is in fact angelic time. St. Thomas Aquinas reasoned that angels are not constrained by our concepts, our world, and they can actually, they have to be at a point in space, but they can be instantaneously across the other side of the world to do it. And he had a reasoning for it, and a bit hard to actually extract, like it's bloody hard work, sorry, if you mind me, bloody hard work actually realising what the grades of arguments are. They're beautifully put together, but that's assumed theological. I think my brother's still got a copy of it somewhere. However, the importance is to realise that this medieval thought pattern is actually being promoted by anyone who should dare ask someone to explain what's going on. So you can sort of see this pattern arriving from Socratica, and the bottom line is that the people there, because they have got a system of enforcing their lack of knowledge on themselves, it doesn't seem all that bad that they can do it on other people. Then Science Teachers Association, I don't say, look, I can arrange it for you, but, you know, ethically, I'd like to actually give the, you know, distinction, give a chance of this idea coming up. You don't have to enforce this idea. And now what's happened, unfortunately, is that the silence means that, look, unfortunately, if you want a sort of access to this group, you have to conform with it and actually not raise any alarm or any worry about it. So that seems okay. But then I had read in Australian textbooks a story about Planck. So this is quantum mechanics again. And this is sort of like the result of quantum mechanics, the idea of energy packets and packets, discrete quanta of energy. And you go, oh, no. If you've actually built lasers and done the Einstein equations and stuff like that, and looked at spontaneous and laser emission, and sort of gone Maxwell's Boltzmann distribution, gone through statistical mechanics at university, when you hear the statement, you go, something's wrong. So, in essential, in essence, where people are taught associative rhetoric, that is, it sounds like this word, sounds like that word, they have the rose, so to speak. So this is really decayed rhetoric, together with sort of a medieval fear of inclusion and psychological pressure. You're not going to think there, but if you've left that, gone to university, understood what it is, come back, you go, this doesn't make sense. When it's distilled into a statement of the syllabus, you can say, that statement is incorrect. This statement has mixed the words quanta and quantum, quantized together. So they're two separate words. Quantized means that boundary conditions will only allow discrete values, and indeed, in that sense, there is a boundary condition of angular momentum. There's only discrete transmissions of angular momentum, but the energy is not a discrete value. It's got a variability. It's quantized. It's a box of probability, and indeed, essentially, if you are not weaned from this counterfeit knowledge of rhetoric, you'll come and produce what I've seen in Australian textbooks. So bear in mind that you've got the poor quality textbooks, untrained teachers, students, you're leading to basically a national disaster. We're presiding over a man-made disaster, which has lasted intergenerational. So the parents, the student will not understand it. He will ask their parents, who can understand it, or their tutor, because they've been taught incorrectly. So it's this nest of incorrect teaching. And so you get this equation in the first equation I've seen in the science book, equals NH. There is actually no way that someone reading this would know what N or H or E or anything was. But they're saying that energy is basically a whole number. Energy is basically a whole number. So you can have 1, 2, 3, a million units of energy, but it's not really a whole number because that number is really large. So it's sort of like a decimal point. You know, it's that your calculator, it can only really express whole numbers because of that number of digits there. But the digits are really small. And this is complete bollocks. And going into it, you've got the counterfeit knowledge people with counterfeit knowledge proposing that they're better and more knowledgeable or more skilled at communication. They might not understand it, but they can sure as hell communicate what they don't understand, which, you know, I think this is a major problem. And then get the self-confidence to put something in a textbook. And this self-assessment of self-confidence is something that we, you know, it's in science, but it's got checks and balances. We have the checks and balances of peer review and referencing, and essentially you have, say, 3 or 5 reviewers, and those reviewers are very skilled in the art, and you don't have to, you can't pick and choose. You have to answer to every one of those reviewers. And then if you've written a paper, someone can write a letter to the editor saying, look, I believe you've made that mistake. Anywhere in history, years after you've written a paper, someone can say, look, so you have made an error in judgment. Would you correct it? So this basic social power play around counterfeit knowledge, which sort of is an essential element of it, because if you look at the way counterfeit knowledge is pushed forward, people are rewarded for recycling it and not knowing it. See, it is unknowable because it's actually not true. And so for this Planck stuff, if you say, look, I'm really interested in quantum physics, let's read a kid's book on it, that or any tangential book or I've reading here, oh, let's read a sideways into it. You are basically like, it's sort of like you want to go to the beach and they basically pop you in Australia, pop you in the wrong direction, and you can go 3,000 kilometres with no sun on the beach. You can see sand, obviously deserts and stuff, it's hot. There's no sea breeze or anything like that. It's, they're putting you in completely, they put a completely incorrect direction. And, so, I'm just trying to think of, these processes tend to actually try and, counterfeit knowledge is sort of like genetic virus or something like that, and it's preserving sort of an ancient tribal power structure. So essentially you could almost have a counterfeit knowledge detector and detect the quantity of counterfeit knowledge, and it might reduce, but then the enforcement will increase and it'll point into this primitive primitive tribe within a modern infrastructure. And what's perhaps more is that micro tribe has got nothing to do anymore. It doesn't have to produce food, it doesn't have to look at defences. All it has to do is really look after itself. So you've got this internally what looks like a modern society, but inside the modern society is this ancient tribal ignorance. And you're walking in society and you suddenly get clubbed and you go, oh, so that hurt. Not retaliating, let's try and analyze what's going on. And essentially you get this clubbing. So with Socratica, there was this, this sort of little step sequence, and then you get clubbed. And then you say, well, okay, you've clubbed me, let's actually deal with this. And you get possibly clubbed again or put out. And then again, there's this real major sequence in terms of in order to actually physically allow, say, this cyclotron stuff, the people have to actually get back to me and I have to transfer the information across. This lack of transfer of information, which is confined to this tribal or way of doing things, means that I've got to read and interpret it. And essentially this is the some of the complex skills, which I suppose I'm not really getting to, where people I'm supposed to pick up these skills, and of course I've got sort of a basic frontier and I'm going 10% at a time, but it doesn't mean that when something doesn't work I sort of say, look at it, what about that has to do with the frontier of my development, my understanding. Okay, 10% of that has to do with it. What has the other 90% got to do with it? Why hasn't this happened? Why don't I get the communication? Now, with that, I then flip that around, reverse and re-engineer it, and just almost try out the theories in reverse and get fairly high speed deep communication where you undermine the tribal barrier and say, oh, I support, do you understand tribalism? Say, this is in support of the leader, this is how it's going, I'm no threat, I can come to me if I can help. This seems good, and the support of this can be translated into tribal reward points, essentially, in a if someone has really no knowledge and is essentially ignorant of maths, it has no value for them. Their only way of operation is that they derive value by providing a valued service. So it's not just any service, it is a service with which they hold, and part of holding the service, the value of their service, is providing the service but also maintaining a level of ignorance where people are basically paying a tax on ignorance. So not necessarily paying for your knowledge, because you could actually perhaps in a shorter time tell them how to do it themselves. That would obviously kill your business. You want to maintain and tax, exact a tax on ignorance. Now, this sort of tax on ignorance sounds sort of like a insane sort of, or someone who's been bitten. Oh, they're just ignorant and stuff like that. However, you know, they don't know as much. If only they knew, which is really sort of almost like a voice from this hidden tribe, so to speak. But in fact, the I'm just trying to catch my breath here. So a hidden tribe, so to speak. The this idea of ignorance having a value is true. So if I have a new car in the showroom, it may be $30,000, I drive it around the block and therefore erase the knowledge of where that car has been, it suddenly drops to $28,000. I take it away for a week, just in a garage, just drive it across the road, put it in a garage for a week, it drops down to 25, and within no time it's at $20,000. There's $10,000 worth of value there. What is that value? Well, the value physically comes up because that amount of money has not been extracted from the car. That is, I could not pay someone $10,000 to restore that value back up to $30,000. That value is in pure knowledge or fear of ignorance. To go across and out, in order to do that, we have guarantees and stuff like that. But a lot of things is based on that now, fear of making a mistake in an ignorant system. So, an ignorant system is not research tolerant. So, if I can give a story about bathtub, our bath. So our bath has a selected tap, an exclusively selected tap, and you look at it and it's dripping, ceramic tap. Ceramic tap is a lifetime guarantee. That is, you pay a premium and they will, for that premium, they will come and replace it forever if you have brand name and the receipt. Of course, we've lost it, so it's dripping. And you look at this bathtub tap, and there is no fixture on it to place a spanner or to do anything with it to undo it. And one could reason that the only way that it could possibly be undone is if you actually pull it beyond its natural thing and just rip it out of the wall. Okay, which could, if you are really not knowing, could cause huge amounts of damage. So it's just easier to let it drip. Until we have a sequence of problems, it's worthwhile to get a plumber. Now, and you'd say, well, the plumber will know what to do. And so the plumber comes in and says, I know that tap simply because I installed that tap in that bathroom many, many years ago, 7 years ago, whatever it is. So I know it, but I cannot tell you how to fix it. It's beyond me. I've never seen it again before. And we are paying a huge amount of money to a plumber to take on the knowledge thing. And it's still the knowledge isn't there. So, but if you look at that simple thing, a tap and a thing, it's contained within a social network of, obviously some ignorance, but also you need the combination of both ignorance and punishment associated with it. So we sort of need to approach this on two things. One is introduce the correct vetted information. B, introduce a system where information is successfully vettable. That is, that for something which is produced, it has a consumer interface, but you can lift it up and see the code in which it's produced, similar to computer code. You've got the app interface, which the consumers use. Behind it, you can actually lift up the code with code notes on it, sufficient notes to allow someone to come and debug it. So it's essentially, we are putting out apps, sort of books, ideas which cannot be debugged. And the same thing is that we've got to replace the valuing of ignorance, which is enforced by punishment system, and replace it with a more open system. That is, say, with this answer to her, the ability to have a just quietly polite professional thing and say, this is the papers produced in such and such a date. This is what they believe. this is a problem which has been found with this. This is the consequence of what you're doing. Can we at least open the door such that you won't close it on anyone who tries to say, oh, but yeah, or it's going across there. It is, I suppose, where it crosses the line of, I suppose, on the other aspect is that a person who peddles counterfeit knowledge really is, that person is not a counterfeiter because they haven't been bright enough to take the knowledge. They have just taken existing knowledge which has got the look and feel of a currency, intellectual currency, and they've just put it across, and they have presented themselves as an authority who has greater knowledge to vouch for it. And so in a sense they are ingenuinely an imposter. There's this imposter. Now, this is what the imposter syndrome is. That is, people who do know and who are hit down all the time feel that they can do well, but they must be an imposter. But the real imposters don't have that imposter syndrome. Now, given this punishment system, one of those people, one of the skills that a successful imposter must have is the ability to direct punishment which cannot be defended against. Like, there's no fear in a threat of punishment if you have got a system where things are fairly explained and you're given a second chance. It must be complete, total, and absolute lethal punishment. And those imposters must be, I'm not saying that these, well, to a certain extent I do know some background history, which says that this is indeed the case. So, when you actually see this, you do see this situation where people get locked into, with counterfeit knowledge, the belief that they are gaining happiness or well-being for something, someone in the group, the greater good of the group, or the long distance, or the needs of others, by inflicting punishment in such a way that it has no redress, no critical avenue for it. And this is the whole sort of human exclusion aspect of it. So, dare I say, in conclusion, I've sort of gone through an arc of quantum physics where I can see this blow by blow, something that's just really obvious and not explained. Think that people overeat, overburn, overspend, overcommit, do all these over things because they desperately want to be included. And if their actions actually did lead to their inclusion, they wouldn't need to do it. So it's called this sort of Skinnerism behavioural. So people are obviously fat and overweight and doing all these stupid things because of aberrant behaviour. And the aberrant behaviour is a sequence which, rather than remove the stimulator or respond to the stimulator, exacerbate it or require you to do more and more to get less and less reliable stimuli. This is your aberrant behavior. So there's no one saying, well, look, hang on, look at this, you're losing all these staff, what's going on? How did we get to here? This is one of the most incredible things that
it seems to be really interesting that counterfactual arguments are a weapon in the hand of someone ignorant predicting the future, but a counterfactual argument of a wise person looking into the past saying, well, here we've got of these 70 staff, 20 have left, being kicked out due to bullying and stress, blah blah blah. How did we get here? Could we have done it another way? It's not so much the answers you generate, it's the quality of the questioning, because obviously the person who has done this obviously believes that there's no other way, and wouldn't, and because they've sort of their actions and their thoughts are all bundled together in an unscrambled knot, they're not going to be able to discuss it, which is indeed sort of a commitment to keep on doing that sort of thing. I suppose I'll try and have to come to the end of my walk now. I have to wrap things up. Hopefully that's been a useful thing. And just look at the walk. It's taking an hour and 36 minutes. Seems to be pretty much the standard amount of time to get down to the causeway. But I'm not feeling it as stuffed as I normally am doing this walk. Thanks for listening.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.